Guys, my name's AJ. I'm an alcoholic. I wanted to say thank you guys actually for giving me the opportunity to do this. I wake up every morning now and I thank God for hopefully the opportunity to be of service to somebody. I believe the whole purpose of this is what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And my sobriety day is not very long ago. It's January 10th, 2025. 15 months sober. And I would say that my life began with problems from a very young age. I guess you could say I was dealt a wrong hand, if that's the perspective. I guess that's the perspective I had at that time. I lost both my parents at 6 years old. The time I did have with my parents that I recall was both drug addicts. Me and my sister in a room, doorknob off, never getting fed the way we needed to be, never clean, never, just never really parented. Never given that love at a young age. And then thankfully my biological mom had people in her life who took us in, and it took about 2 years for them to go through the process legally. So I had to stay in DCFS, an adoption agency in Blaisdell, New York. So I was there for 6 to 8, and I was tormented, by kids older than me, people in charge. I don't like going into that much. I don't know if I'm ready to speak about everything I went through when I was in that program, but I was adopted by my dad now and my stepmom now, and both are sober, both are good people, but both are very emotionally damaged people, and I don't think they understood me. I don't think they understood addiction. They never really had it within their lives that much, and alcohol was normal in the house. They did drink, I would say. They, when it comes to sober to me, I would say like no hard drugs, no weed, right? But my dad drank. He was in a band, Seven Faces. I don't know if anybody knows it. It's a local band, but he had that party lifestyle. The band members came to my house every Sunday to practice, and I'd constantly see alcohol sitting around the house. I'd see people talking about things I probably shouldn't be listening to, but at a young age, I idolized my father, especially being taken in by somebody who was so well balanced in life. I assumed that that's what I wanted to be, a rock star, or someone who had all these friends that could talk all the time and just had parties at their house, just had all this confidence that I seemed to lack, because I felt like every room I walked into, it went quiet, or no one wanted to really talk to me. I didn't really have much to talk about. But the second I found alcohol and I picked up, I remember I was 11 years old, turning 12, is when I had my first drink. I picked up my dad's like warm Budweiser can, and I didn't like the taste of alcohol, so I didn't drink it for a long time. I found weed instead at 13 and pills. I was diagnosed with bipolar at a young age and OCD. So I would abuse my medication, from 13 to 16. And my life wasn't really, I had a normal childhood up until that point, I would guess you would say. Obviously, I teetered with problems, with mental problems and drugs, but it wasn't life consuming yet. It wasn't, my life hadn't hit bottom. I just thought I was a kid with problems that every kid had, I thought this was normal. I thought everything about my life was normal, but it wasn't. And at 16, COVID hit. I was in high school, junior year. And that gave me so much time to just sit in my house and do drugs and alcohol. And I fell in love with everything about it. I fell in love with the feeling of it. I fell in love with isolating myself and not talking to anybody. I fell in love with that I could sit there on my phone and talk to anybody I want. I could be anybody I wanted to be. And all I had to do for school was do this. I'm used to this, talking through Zoom. This is what I did for 2 years straight to get my degree, or my diploma. And I bullshitted my way all the way through it. I sat right here and I lied, and I graduated with a 4.0, because there was a lot of people in my school who graduated with that, because they just handed you out the diploma. And I was in AP courses, you know, and during that time, you didn't have to take the AP exam. So I was basically just sitting around, and I wouldn't say they were, I don't know how to put it. I wouldn't say they were like helping me out or just, I don't even know how to put it with the school thing, because they didn't teach me anything and they didn't notice. Like, had I been in an environment where teachers maybe would have been able to see me physically collapsing and deteriorating, maybe. But I met my ex-girlfriend, the mother of my two children now. I met her through Instagram, through one of my just spirals, right? I met her online and we started talking, and I met her in person, and we hit it off. And I put the drugs down, you know, because she asked me to. You know, I was able to put the hard pills down and the weed, and I didn't have a problem with alcohol yet. I would say I didn't have a problem with alcohol. The first time I should have noticed I had a problem with alcohol was at Woodlawn Beach. It was at 17. Me and her were at the beach, and I had drinking myself into blackout. You know, I drank a whole bottle of Pink Whitney. And I blacked out at the beach, and I had to get my stomach pumped at the hospital. And my dad recorded me for just me sitting there pissing myself, throwing up on myself. The security guards having to restrain me down. It took four Buffalo policemen, way bigger than me, and I'm 5'6", 130. It took four fully grown police to hold me down. And I got scars on my arm because I broke the restraint wraps twice. And I woke up with purple marks. Purple, deep black marks all over my arms and just embedded in my arm from them having to hold me down with restraint wraps, straps. And the most emotional part about that for me is him, my dad just recording me. And sometimes he shows me that video and he's like, this is where it really started for you, you know, with our problems. And alcohol became, I wouldn't say the focus then, even then, you know, but that's where it started, the taste of what it could be. And I had a kid, and I was very scared to become a father at a young age. And although we had planned this kid because we both needed direction, all I ever wanted in my life was a family to raise my as my own, because I'd never, I did get obviously adopted, but I wanted to have my own family and raise them the way that the kids should be raised, because as much as the problems I had with my family growing up, you know, I wanted to show, wanted to be somebody, you know, that, because I always got in arguments with my parents. We never agreed about nothing. My way I view with, the way I view life with people is not the same other people view it. At least that's how I felt. You know, I couldn't agree. I could never fit in. I could never agree. And I knew that if I had my chance to raise my own kids with somebody, that I could do it my own way. And no one could tell me different. So I moved out. You know, I moved out at 18 years old. Because my dad said, you're not going to raise no babies in this house. And you're not going to use or drink or do any of that stuff in my house. And my ex was super against that stuff. It, believe it or not, she did not like me drinking. She did not like me using weed. She was super against it because her father was a heroin addict. You know, when I would go to her house, I'd walk in and this dude's in the bathtub, butt naked, you know, and he's got three girls. And I'd have to walk in there and turn my head away or close a curtain. And the one day I got so sick of it, you know, I think it was a year into the relationship, and she was pregnant. And I walk in there, and he's got his thing hanging out. And I pull him out the bathtub, and I go off on her dad. You know, at the time, I didn't realize that I had emotional problems too. You know, what the book says, mental. Some people suffer from grave mental disorders, you know, and emotional problems. But if we're honest with ourselves, you know, we can treat those things. But I was never honest. Not with the way I lived, not with the way I talked, not with the way I did anything in my life. I lied constantly about where I was going. You know, I was a butcher at Niagara Produce off Millersport. And every morning I worked 7 to 4. And I would say at about 2 years into my job when I was 20, alcohol was a problem. Alcohol was a problem, but I didn't realize it. And I was lying to her about where I was going. I would stop right at the liquor store at 7 in the morning. I was doing like it was very for me, it wasn't. I would say alcohol took over my life in a very short time. I didn't wasn't the party type because I wasn't allowed to be. She didn't like me going out to hang out with my friends, or I was definitely not going to a bar, So I would go out and I would drink in my car, or I would drink at work, or I would drink at home. I thought I was a good dad because I'd come home and take care of my son or cook dinner or do the dishes or this, but I was still drinking, and I was there physically, but I was not there emotionally. I was not there the way I should have been there. And it's the stuff still eats me up and it's still new to me, but I can be accountable for what I did, especially to my ex and to my kids. And I would drive around drunk with them, my whole family, Just to backtrack a little bit, I'm sorry if I'm going over a place a little bit, but my son was born October 19th, 2022. 2023, sorry. And when I held him, I named him Miles because he sounded like a race car when he came out. And I was sober that night. But the second that she came back from her C-section, like you would think like maybe let her sleep a little bit, right? And she's just went through a major surgery. Like cut through every layer of her skin, unplanned C-section. She was devastated that she had to cut through. Like she did not want to change her body. She valued her body, right? As most women do. And I couldn't give her even that respect to let her sleep a little bit. I ran right out of there and I went and I used. I went and I used. And at the time, I was using cocaine too. I was shooting up liquid cocaine. That's why I say alcohol wasn't that king. It wasn't king alcohol for me yet. It was still, I still had other drugs of choice at the time because I didn't realize what alcohol was about to do to me. And 21 years old, alcohol, May 25th was my birthday, 2025. And I turned 21 years old. At the time now, I have two children, a young daughter, not even, what is she? March, April. She's 2 months at the time. And my son is two, and she gets me a cake, and it's got shooters on it. It's got four shooters on it. And I remember taking all four back to back to back to back, because she told me to, right? She's like, oh, happy birthday, right? Take the shots, whatever. At least I thought she meant to take all four. Now I know she didn't mean to take all four, but that's what I just instinctively did. And I don't recall them singing happy birthday. I don't remember them giving me my gifts. I just remember saying, oh, fuck all this. And I walked out of there, and that was the first time I went and I hit a bar because I needed more, And I didn't have my ID at the time yet. So I couldn't go to the liquor store, but I knew the dude who runs the bar right down the street from me to this day. So I went down there and I was like, man, I'm 21. Like, I don't got my ID yet, or they won't serve me alcohol until it's 24 hours past my birthday. And he's like, oh, I got you, man. I'll serve you. So I get popped at the bar, come home absolutely wasted. And I walk in the house and she's happy. She doesn't even give a fuck. She's like, oh, did you have a good time? I'm like, yeah. And I come back and she's got a case of Twisted Tea. Like, at the time, I didn't realize she was just, she thought she was being a good girlfriend, right? I'm 21. I've been working with my kids, She doesn't understand that I've been drinking on the side, right? But not at the level that it was gonna turn into. I thought I was just, when I was drinking, it was like a numbing. It was to keep going with the cocaine. Because I don't know if anybody knows about shooting up cocaine, but when you put it up in your arms, or it burns, right? Like it fucking burns. So when you drink alcohol, you don't feel that. You don't feel any burning sensation in your body, like because you have to mix the cocaine with alcohol too. So if I'm buying the alcohol, I'm not gonna waste it. I'm not just gonna sit there and mix what I got. I'm gonna drink the rest of it. But now I started to realize that I love alcohol. I love what it did to me. And in just a short time, man, over the next 10 months from May to January, my life was consumed by alcohol. I don't know how to explain it. It was just every day. I drank every day for 10 months. And I went through like $20,000. And she left me. On January 2nd, she went to a domestic violence shelter with my kids, even though that we had four documented reports of her abusing me and beating me. I didn't call the cops on her because I didn't want to misplace my kids. I didn't want to put them on the streets. So I just drank. I took out my PTO because the new year just started. And I from January 2nd to January 7th, I drank myself to oblivion. You know, it was just 5 days of straight. Just curtains closed. And by the time I came to my, it was January 7th, and I was throwing up blood in my toilet. And I thought, okay, this is fine. Like, I didn't know it was blood. I thought it was just red at the time. So the next day I go to work, I try to go to work because my PTO is over and I'm fucking shaking. And I'm trying to hold my blade because I'm a butcher. And at the time, my boss, Antonius Mellon Jr., he runs a Clothing Kills Cancer Foundation here in Lockport. He's kind of been a dude that's been looking out for me for the past year or two when I've been coming to him. And I just go into his office and I'd say, Tony, I can't do this anymore. Like, I quit. Like, I can't pick up the blade, bro. Like, I can't run the bandsaw. I'm leaving gars off. I'm throwing the hatchet back, my cleaver. I'm putting it 10 inches back past my head. You can't go past the side of your head with a cleaver when you're a butcher because you could take someone's head out. I'm sitting there just going to town, you know, acting like I'm the man running this place, right? Because at the whole time, my ego is consuming me. Like, I'm the man. I'm leap cut. Like, no one's going to tell me shit. My family just left me. I'm walking in there. That's how I thought I was going to walk in there. I walk in there. I can't even pick up the blade, man, on that January 8th. And I realized how sick I was. And I'm wearing three sweatshirts because, like, I didn't, like, I realized how skinny I'd gotten, but I didn't own a scale. So I never weighed myself, right? Like, what guy my age owns a fucking scale? So I never weighed myself and I don't go to the doctor, right? So I just thought I noticed myself getting skinny. I noticed my face kind of coming in. And my ex would say stuff like, look how disgusting you are. Like, look at your ribs. Look at you. Like, she would shove my face in the mirror. And this is before she left. This was December. And I remember taking all the mirrors out of my house. I took the bathroom medicine cabinet off the wall. I would shower in the dark. 'Cause I just hated the way my body looked, you know, I couldn't stand it. And yeah. She left in January 8th. I confided in my boss. I said I couldn't do it anymore. And he said, I want you to go talk to somebody. His name's Dougie Fresh. And I don't want you to come back until you talk to him. And he tells me you talk to him. So he gives me this dude's number, and at the time I'm driving, so I drive to this meeting. It's at 8 o'clock at night, and I'm like, what the hell? Because the time he gives me this at 9 in the morning, and at that time I'm in full-blown alcoholism. Like, I can't go the day without not drinking. So I tell him, I'm like, Tony, I'm gonna show up to this dude's place wasted. He's like, that's fine, just show up. So I'm like, okay. So I show up there, and I'm not wasted, but I'm drunk, you know. I'm definitely feeling all right. And I walk in there, and I didn't look at the time right, so I got there 30 minutes early. And Dougie was already there. So I had a one-on-one with Dougie. And just from talking to him for 30 minutes, he's like, I want you to stay from the meeting, but you're an alcoholic. And I think you'd be better off going to an AA meeting. And at the time, I don't really know what any of this stuff is, right? This stuff is so taboo to me. I'm like, I'm talking, this dude's talking to me about NA and AA. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about, bro? Right? And he's like, we got places for people who can come here and they can find a better way to live. And I'm like, I just don't. I'm like, what are you talking about, a better way to live? What am I doing that's so wrong? Right? I'm going through a bad breakup. I'm going through a bad relationship. I'm just young. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not a drug addict. I'm just going through a rough time at a young age. And he's like, no, man, you're an alcoholic. And you're probably a drug addict too. But you know what? It sounds like you're more of an alcoholic. And he's saying these things to me. And I'm giving him full discretion to do so because I don't understand. You know, I'm trying to understand because I'm willing. At this point, I don't understand, but I'm willing, you know? And that's where that sense of willing was starting to come into me. I could feel it building up. But that night, I went home and I drank even more. And when I got home, it was 9 p.m. And I drank till 12 a.m. And I went in the bathroom throwing up drunk, and it was blood. It was all blood, right? And I call a hope line because at this point, I don't care that I made it to my boss, right? Or that I made it to my boss. I don't care. Or that I made it to the meeting that my boss wanted me to go to, or this or anything. I'm at this point, I'm like, I feel like I'm gonna die right now. Like, why am I throwing up blood? Like, my stomach hurts, this, that, the third. And I called the Hope Line and I tell them that my whole story that I'd kind of just told you, but probably even all more over the place because I'm drunk. And she's like, we can save your life. Like, we can buy you a plane ticket right now and you can come to rehab. And I'm like, what is rehab? Like, what do you mean? Like, you can just buy me a plane. You're just gonna buy me a plane ticket. You don't even know me. Like, this doesn't sound like this feels like bullshit. But I at this point, I got nothing else. My ex is gone. I had a phone call with her grandpa the day prior, and he's like, you need to be a man and you need to do something about this. And I tried reaching out to her, and she wants nothing to do with me. She's done, right? She's over it. 4 years, she's done. She don't care no more. And I'm just like, I got nothing else to live for at this point. I got no other choice really other than to give it a shot. So that's what I did, you know. And the day before, they scheduled my flight for that Friday, and it was January 8th. So I go the next day because I don't care. I was ready. I didn't need a day, you know. I did not need a day. I needed to go. But I did have my dad stop at the liquor store. I drank like four or five shooters before I walked into the airport. And then I paid the bartender at the airport to make sure I didn't miss my flight because I knew I would miss it if I sat down and sat there and began to drink, which I did. Because they gave me like five free drink coupons, right? And I tried using them at the bar, but they're like, nah, this is for the flight. And I'm like, well, shit. So in my head, I'm like already planning, like, damn, I got five drinks for the flight. Right. But I drank about 2 hours deep before the flight. And then the bartender was like, it's time to go, bro. You're gonna miss your flight. So I rush over to the gate, board up, and it's a 7 hour flight to California, which is where I'm heading. I'm heading to San Diego, California. And that whole plane ride there, there's three kids that are going to a lacrosse competition. And I start talking to the one kid because I got no one to talk to and I'm drunk, right? And I'm just talking this kid's ear off. And he's like, I don't even, and then he notices that I'm getting alcohol, right? The very first drink I get. And he just stops talking to me, right? He don't want nothing to do with me no more after that. And I'm just like, well, that sucked. That kind of feels shitty because, like, yeah, I mean, when I'm, because it's, time zones are changing throughout the plane. So by the time, like, I boarded my plane at 9 in the morning and I'm getting Jameson throughout the whole plane ride. And, like, it felt like it was morning time the whole plane ride, but, like, eventually it's 1 p.m. And, like, I've used four free drink coupons and I've lost track of time and everything. I don't even know what's going on. My phone died. And I get off in the layover in Vegas. And my phone's dead. I'm broke. I'm drunk. And I'm pissed. I'm discontent. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know who to talk to. I feel like this is all bullshit now. And I'm starting to come, like, this is what I do. I start to come up. I know, I've always known what's right. And I've always known what I've done or what I'm doing to myself could be dangerous, right? But I've always struggled with, like, do I want to live a better life? Do I want to stop? Do I want to really put myself first? And I sat down at this Wendy's because that's where I had been working as a second job at the time. And I don't know why, but like for some reason, I veered towards that Wendy's. And I'm sitting down, and this dude comes over. He's like, "Yo, you want the rest of this burger? I'm not gonna finish it." And I'm like, "Yeah." So I take that dude's burger because I've had nothing to eat for the whole plane ride all day. Matters of fact, you know. And it's at that point, it's 7 p.m. And I'm finally eating something. And I'm just shaking because at that point, it had also been 2 hours without a drink, and I got no money. And my ex sends me $15, right? Because she called my dad like 100 times, because everyone in my family thought this was bullshit. They all thought there's no way he's actually going to do this, right? And she called my dad 100 times, and my dad finally picked up and was like, "Yeah, he's actually in California. He's actually doing it." And my dad's telling me he loves me and he's proud of me. And I didn't realize how many people I had affected at this point, or how deeply I'd affected people with what I was doing to myself and what I had already done. And that burger was just the first sign that maybe people can be good. Maybe life can be good. Like when I'm down on my, like, because if I'm down on my knees, man, like that burger just saved me. And then I go up to the span. Spanish dude, because he's the only person I see that's sitting at the charger docks, because they got like a station there in the airport where you can like charge your phone, and he was the only one there that had the charger I needed, because you had to bring your own charger to the dock, and I didn't have money to buy one. And he speaks just fluent Spanish; he don't speak English, so I just point at his charger, and I'm like, "Can I go?" And I just give him 5 minutes, and he just hands me it, and he's like, "Yeah." So like that was another one that at this time I don't know that these are God shots, right? I don't know that God's guiding me to where I need to be right now. But the whole time that I was planning on giving up, I was looking for a reason to give up. People kept giving me reasons to keep going, get to the next flight and give it a shot. You know? So I wait the 2 hour layover and I get into my plane. My phone's charged. You know, I was able to call my dad. I was able to call my on the phone the person who got me the flight and everything, her name was Sarah. And she kind of would call me in between flights just to make sure everything was going straight and forward. And the whole time I was checking in with her, like, just everything she was saying, like, this could be it. Like, you could change your life. Like, you could have so much to live for. You got no idea. You're so young. You have no idea what type of people come into these places. And they just, and there's so many things she's saying. I'm honestly feeling like she's just bullshitting me. And that this is just like, I'm about to get like sent to Tijuana, right? And get my organs taken or some shit. So I get to San Diego and I get off the plane. And I'm the dude that's supposed, they call me and like they're like, "Hey, your dude that's supposed to pick you up isn't coming to get you. There's another dude coming, but he's gonna be about an hour and a half. Can you wait?" And I'm like, "You want me to wait an hour and a half at this airport? Like, what do you want me to do? Like I'm like on the I'm on verge right now." And they're like, "You just need to wait." And like I got $15 in my pocket, right? That my sister sent me. And I just keep thinking about this $15. Like, I could say fuck it right now. Fuck New York, fuck my kids, fuck everyone, and just start a new life in California. They bought me a free ride here. I could take advantage of that, just like I've taken advantage of everybody in my life right now, and just take advantage of you too. But I set my ass on that curb outside the airport. I sat on my suitcase, and I waited an hour and a half for my car to pull up. And I didn't leave it. I didn't leave my suitcase. At that moment, that suitcase was, for some reason, the most important thing to my life, like in my life. I was gripping on it for dear life and I wasn't letting go. Because if I let go of that suitcase and I said, fuck it, I'm starting a new life, I wouldn't be sitting here. I never would have came home. I wouldn't see my kids. Because right now I get to see my kids, you know? But rehab, California saved my life. The people out there saved my life. The very first night I get out of the car, I'm thrown up. I walk in there. The first thing he says to me, "This isn't a jail. This isn't a prison. You can leave right now." And those thoughts start shooting back into my head again. Like, you can walk out and go start a new life. But no, like they start, and then he follows up with, "But this is the better way." And look at that. And then he starts to show me how they're living and that there's other people here that want more for themselves. And I guess it's just to me, they made it, they showed me how the program could be so simple, and how. And the people in California, when I'm walking in AA rooms full of 200 people, I shit you not, every meeting had 100 to 200 people in it. There was not a meeting I didn't walk into that was less than. And you only get 3 minutes to speak. They got a timer. They have a timer position, right? That's crazy. But in 3 minutes, I was able to learn how to talk and share how, like, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, you know? And I feel like I came back. I don't want to jump ahead yet. I want to stay in California. But when it comes to California, in the Asiana Gardens, I found God, you know, the meditation gardens. And I learned how to meditate. And the guide showed us how to breathe, you know, through our hearts and through our souls, and not just through our lungs and our nose, in our mouth. Like, that's cliche, right? It sounds cliche, but there's so much more to our bodies that we can learn about than just destroying it. And in California, it taught me how to, you know, take care of my body and to be grateful, truthfully be grateful for each and every single day, because there was a time where I would wake up just sick every day and shaking, and it took me 4 days in California to detox, you know, with the meds and Valium and bed rest and throwing up sick, and it I was 86 pounds, right? Going back to that scale, when I got to California, I was 86 pounds, and I was at a 3 point, I was at 0.34 was my BAC, and they don't understand how I was alive, right? They thought I should be dead, and maybe I should have been dead. Because that's what the goal was at the time, was I didn't care. I was hopeless and despair. I didn't know what those words meant because I was naive. You know, I was ignorant to the fact that there could be so much more to life than just chasing a high, chasing that instant gratification that liquor gave me. Because to me, it was like the second I had that warmness and that hotness hit my chest, everything else was okay. You know, I could continue to do what I needed to do, pills, drugs, talk to people, lie, cheat, still it was okay. As long as I had that stuff, as long as I had an excuse to fall back onto, you know, it was the drugs, it was the alcohol that did that. I'm just young. It wasn't me. At some point, I looked around the rooms and I kept hearing people just saying, like, I had to figure it out. I had to become accountable. I had to want it. I had to want it. You know, I was willing. I wanted willingness. And I just decided I want this. It was that simple for me. And I'm in those rooms because I had to go to HA meetings and NA meetings, and they had boundary meetings. They had sexual abuse meetings out in California. I mean, I was in the recovery center of the world. You know, how could I not find out what recovery was about? And that was what I intended to do. That's the whole reason why I went there, was to figure out how to recover. And I walked out of there after 30 days. And I flew home, and I'm not gonna say, because 14 days into the program, I wanted to leave, and I said I got it. I had court, my ex was talking about court, and threatening me with this and that, and I was getting scared about that. And I thought I could come home and fix my family, you know. I hadn't even tried working on myself yet, and I thought I could come home after 14 days and step back into my old life and think everything was gonna be fine and fix it. Just so naive and just. Sick, just so sick still, you know. And I had my counselor say, "Oh, you got it, you can leave. He's got it, guys." And they all laughed at me. And at the time, I'm pissed. "What do you mean you're laughing at me? Because I got it, because I said I got it." They're like, "You got it, right? Go ahead and fucking leave. You don't need us, you got it." "No, I don't got it, man. I did not have it. I was not ready to leave." And I sat there and I swallowed that pill and I told myself, "Go, if I can go 14 days, I can go 16 more." And I can see what they mean by that. And they said, "You can't say you got it, man. It's one day at a time. It's not, I got this." I don't say that. Even today, I don't say always. I don't use words like that. You know, always, hate, never. Because we just don't know. It's one day at a time for everything in my life now. Not just with sobriety, not just with alcoholism and drugs. It's one day at a time with everything I do. With the way I eat, I make sure I eat 3 meals a day. I make sure I clean. I make sure I do everything I'm supposed to do, you know, to make sure I don't go back to slipping up into the old lifestyle I had. And that rehab taught me that people sometimes don't, I don't know, people's opinions on rehab vary. And I think it's all about what you wanted at the time you were there. You know, what was your perspective like while you were there? It's the same thing with meetings. Take what you need and leave the rest. So I go in and I wanted to get to that. I come back from California, right? And I'm feeling great. I feel like I do understand that I need to live a better life. I need to stop drinking. I can't live that life. And that's what I'm doing, right? I'm doing everything I'm supposed to. I have my car. I'm going to AA every single day. And I fell in love with the program. And I fell in love with the idea of it and the people within the program. Because for the first time in my life, I could come somewhere and I needed to be honest. In order for my mental health and for my sobriety to stay consistent, I needed to be honest. And this is the first place where I felt like I could truly be honest and be me. And although they might judge, that's okay. At least they understand me. And now, when I come to Lockport, there is no timer. There's maybe 20, 30 people, and that's okay. It's not about how many people are there, and it's not about how it's structured. The program is so simple. It's about the desire to stop drinking and your willingness to want it. And I get judged, that's okay. I did crash my car off my medication. And now my parents could be my medication because when it comes to things like that, I understand now I can't control anything I put in my body that changes the way I think or do. And I'm going through the legal consequences for that. I'm taking it one step at a time. I've paid my fines. I've done my community service. I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm about to be in a car next month once my suspension is fully lifted. And I do thank God because I'm here, and I could not be here. I could have died. No, I could have died many times, just like we all could have, right? But I think June 24th was also I think that was my final wake-up call. And at least I'm not going to say never, because I learned that. But at least not today, I'm not going to drink. And if it wasn't for the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, if it wasn't for people telling me that you need to find a sponsor right now and you need to stop talking like you need to stop, because I'm a very emotional person, but now I can speak without my emotions getting involved in it. And I couldn't go through a meeting without dumping my tears on the floor or hyperventilating or just so distraught and just so sick. That's how I keep going because I was sick. But now I get better every day. And after 15 months, of consistently not putting alcohol in my body, I don't feel so sick anymore. I feel very good about myself. And I get time. I value the time I have with my two children. My kids, I don't think they might have seen me drink at a young as a baby, but they won't remember that. And they're not, my goal is for them to never see that, at least with me. I have my own place. I'm sitting in it. It's quiet. I can be content now with quietness. I used to not be able to sit on the couch. And I used to just have to have something, music. And that's what the alcohol and drugs did. It gave me constant stimulation. But now I can sit here, and the only stimulation I really need is an hour a day with people who think like me. And I still do this every day. I'm not forced to come here. I look at people with papers. I don't care. I do not care. Honestly, I don't care about anybody in those rooms. When they come in there, what they got outside them, it's not my business. It's outside my hula hoop. And if it's not going to help my recovery, if it might tamper with it, I keep it away from me now. The meeting that John here, who had found me or who I had spoken to at the meeting, people take me to meetings now that I don't got my car. And I find people at these meetings. I meet people like Sean, and I hear names on that list that I do recognize. And it's like, none of these people are my age. Yeah, I think about them more than I ever have about anyone else that I've ever met. I think about you people, my sponsor. For some reason, you guys, I don't know, you care more about me than anyone else ever really has in my life. Truthfully speaking, it's like you guys, you care about what might come. What we're supposed to do, what you care about continuing the program of recovery. And if it wasn't for people who kept doing it before you and what you're doing now, people my age who come into the program with their heads down, shaking, crying to the floor, they wouldn't understand it. I'm still learning. I'm still trying to figure out what I want to be in life. And I'm still learning a lot about this program, and I still have a lot of work to do, you know. I gotta go through the rest of the steps. I've gone through the steps, all of them, but not thoroughly. You know, not all 12 of my sponsor, and that's the goal. The goal is for me to go through all 12 to figure out the full idea of this program. You know, I want to grasp on it. I want to be able to live through my sobriety and my recovery. I want to be able to truly live through that each day. And I thank God now, you know, I've given myself, I've surrendered to God because I was hopeless. I was sick, and I've understand now. I keep it simple that alcohol is not going to give me anything but pain. And even if it doesn't mess my life up, even if I can't get away with it for a day or a month or a year, what's it going to give me in those moments? You know, it's not going to give me anything I want, nothing that I had. What I got right now, what this has given me, has seriously opened my eyes up. You know, I'm going back to school in the spring. And everything in the fall, sorry, and everything about this program has given me that because I go through the Beacon Center for outpatient where I got to go pee in a cup, but they gave me these papers where I could sign up for free college, you know, and I got approved because I have a disability with alcoholism. You know, when I went through rehab, I was diagnosed with an alcoholism disability. And it's like at the same time, I can sit here and let these things define me, or I can use them and I can choose to want to do better, you know, and I'm not gonna let this disease of addiction, you know, I'm not gonna succumb to it. You know, I surrender, but I'm not gonna succumb. I'm not gonna sit there and let this bring me down and take me with it, just like it did majority of my family, you know. Both my biological parents, both my brothers. I have a younger sister who's fully in college, who has never drank, who doesn't use that stuff. She want one path and I want the other. And I've seen how not using that stuff can give you so much more than what it gave me when I was picking it up. And I'm gonna continue to keep coming back. And each day I choose AA and I choose you people, and I want to thank you guys for allowing me to be of service, to share my story, because it feels good. And I hope, you know, with 2 years and 3 years and 4 years, I take it one day at a time, but I hope I can continue to live through my sobriety and just become smarter and gain more and have more time with my kids and find a job I like, you know, and see what life's really all about and what it has to offer. And all thanks to alcoholism and AA, you know, and the disease of addiction, I've been able to find out that life does give you the wildest things. You can have the most wildest, what do they say? Your most wildest dreams can come true. The most cliche things I hear in these rooms, man, they brighten up my life. They seriously make my life better. And thank you guys. That's all I got.